Welcome back to the Yoga Teacher Training Podcast. Today, I am joined by Todd Norian. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So Todd has published a book about Tantra Yoga. He's got some incredible workshops and teacher trainings coming up. We're going to talk about Tantra and some of Todd's philosophy from 40 plus years of teaching. And I'm just grateful to have you. We're going to kind of let the conversation flow organically in a lot of topics, but I'm excited to hear from you and learn from you.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here, and I'm really looking forward to the conversation, Jeremy.
So one of the things that I want to just kind of jump into something here is in the emails when we talked, you mentioned the Shiva Nataraja dance and talking about that. It's something that a lot of studios we see when we go to studios or we see in iconography or we see that symbol. And a lot of people don't really know why we see that, what it means, what it represents. But I think it's really, from my understanding, really integral to understanding Tantra and deeper parts of yoga philosophy. But we just see, you know, like somebody dancing with a bunch of arms sometimes. And what does it mean? Why is it in all these yoga studios? So I'm curious if we just start there, like, what is that all about?
Great choice. Well, the dancing Nataraja, so Shiva Nataraja means Lord of the Cosmic Dance. He's really the Ishta Devata, which means sort of the chosen deity of Tantra. Sort of like the mascot deity, because we have all these other deities, you know, all the goddesses and Ganesh, you know, the elephant-headed god, and Lakshmi, the goddess of beauty and abundance and wealth. They're all wonderful, but this Nataraja is really sort of the essence. He represents the essence of the view of Tantra, and especially the Tantra that I teach, which is called the non-dual Shaiva Shakta Tantra, which is kind of a mouthful, but it goes back about 1,000 to 1,500 years back, and you know, it's in text, and it's really been a phenomenal path for me to understand where life is depicted in this statue. So just the idea that he's dancing is really the first message, which is that life can be a dance. In fact, you know, the question is, why is Nataraja dancing? Which we might as well just say, why is life happening? Which is an ancient question. Like, we're all asking, like, well, why am I here? Who am I? Why am I here? And what am I supposed to be doing this lifetime? And I think luckily for all of us as yoga teachers, like, we found a path, and it's such a rewarding path to teach, you know, that we're in service to this greater energy. So Nataraja is dancing for the play of it, meaning for no reason at all. He's dancing for the delight. And this idea that life is meant to be enjoyed, life is meant to be savored, is part of the tantric teaching. There are many paths that teach us to get into the body, to get out of the body. In other words, the transcendent path or the renunciate path, the renunciate path, which I was on actually for a significant number of years before I found Tantra. You can think of the renunciate path as a very high path. It's really not suitable for most people. They say like 1 in 500 people can actually do a successful renunciate path. But there's so much to learn from it. But to understand that the whole view of the renunciate path is that life is suffering. And so we want to transcend this life to get out. And the whole goal then of our yoga practice is at some point we'll burn off so much karma that we never have to come back again. Or we become bodhisattvas, which is we choose to come back to help other people transcend. But the whole idea is it's a transcendent, it's a one-way ticket, you know. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I'm just explaining, like, oh, this is the view that the word samsara, which means a lot of different things, but basically it means the disease of worldliness, which is saying that, you know, we're here because we failed last time. We're here because we're still needing to learn what we need to do to burn off our karma so that we can be pure and not have to come back to this godforsaken place. I'm exaggerating this, but I want to point out that there's reasons why people follow the renunciate path, you know. And it usually follows a more dualistic view. Patanjali's view is dualistic. It's classical yoga. So it's like there's nature and there's spirit and they don't connect. And spirit is superior. So it makes sense in that paradigm that we want to transcend nature, which includes the body, the mind, our desires. You know, the view of desire in the classical tradition is that desire is the beginning of the end. Like you should really attenuate all your desires. You know, because desire is, pleasure is just pain in disguise, you know. So Tantra comes along and says, hey, wait a minute, life can be pretty good sometimes. And if you learn to see nature as an extension of spirit, that nature is the full-blown expression, then you get the dancing Nataraja. He's dancing not because life is a dirge, but life is a dance. And it's a dance of paradox, which paradox is very difficult to understand. Because in the non-dual approach that I teach, there's unity consciousness in everything. There's one unified field, you know. The one infinite energy chooses to limit itself out of its own delight, out of its own joy, to become limited. It's called swa prachodana, which means to self-conceal. So this Nataraj represents the one universal energy that chooses to conceal itself in order to be in the dance of life, to have the joy of revelation. And if you think about it, there's no revelation unless you're concealed, you know, and he's dancing on top of the imp of forgetfulness, which is called the Apasmara Purusha. I have one here. Do you mind if I reach over and just grab it?
You do, yeah.
Let's see if it's, it was kind of glued down on a table, but this is, I think your people can see this. If they have video, they can see it.
Yeah.
So he's dancing in the circle of fire, and it's known as the circle of grace or the circle of fire or the circle of light. And it represents, there's usually 50 to 54 fires here, which represents all the letters in the Sanskrit alphabet, and that represents all possibilities, because the Sanskrit is like all utterable sounds that humans can make. So he's dancing, he's telling us there's hope here, like we're dancing in this circle of all possibilities at all times. And he's dancing on top of, there's the little guy, imp of forgetfulness. That's us, that's the ego. And he's looking up at the answer to forgetfulness, which is the lifted foot of grace. So Nataraja permits this apas purusha, which means, apas means away from, and purusha means remembering. So away from remembering is forgetfulness. So Nataraja permits this little imp, like our ego, to live. He's not killing it, but he's got it. He's managing it, you know. It's like we need to create healthy self-boundaries to manage our ego. And this imp of forgetfulness is looking up at the lifted foot of grace. It's called Kanchikapada. And that really becomes the answer, that as ego selves, we need to understand that greatness is knowing that we are greater than ourselves, that there's a bigger energy than just us, of which we're part of, and we're a significant part because we have agency. So in the Tantra, we're not trying to kill the ego. You know, ego becomes like our uniqueness, our individuality, and it becomes the gift of our embodiment, compared to the renunciate paths where we want to eliminate the ego. And in fact, the classical Buddhist traditions is to eliminate the self. That's the concept of no self, you know. So in Tantra, if you think of it like waves on the ocean, the waves contain the ocean in them. But when we're cut off and isolated, we often walk around as oceanless waves. So there's some traditions that try to erase the wave. And the Tantra is, no, man, we want to learn how to surf the waves. You know, in classical yoga, it's let's get off the wheel of karma. And in Tantra, it's not so much a wheel, like the perpetual cycle of incarnation. You know, we live, you know, we're born, we live, we die, and then we are reborn again. And that's considered a problem, you know, like in the classical tradition, like we want to stop that cycle. So we do yoga practice to, you know, try to purify ourselves to stop. But in Tantra, they say, yeah, souls tend to reincarnate. That's just what they do. Let's get out our surfboard and learn how to surf these waves, to be able to go up and down, and to be able to understand that everything in life is for our awakening. Everything. And if we take that view, then when challenges come, they don't come to like push us down. Challenges only come when you're ready to rise up. I like to say when you're ready for a promotion, you know, like the universe never gives you challenges that you can't handle. And yeah, some challenges are really huge, you know, and we go through maybe days or weeks or months of confusion, trauma, sometimes the wound. But the Tantra is saying, no, stand in the gift of your wound, because everything in life is for our awakening, even the very difficult issues that we have. So Nataraja is telling us to dance in the waves. And just a couple other little things that I think are really interesting. He has four arms, and up at the top, he has one arm that's holding a drum. It's a two-sided drum, and it represents creation, like the tick-tock of time. It also represents the paradox. There's two sides to this drum. It's called the Damaru. And there's always two things, like you are yourself, and you're the whole universe all at the same time, you know? It's a paradox. And what we think is suffering is actually a doorway to our unlimited infinite consciousness. And with an attitude like that, then obstacles become opportunities. Stumbling blocks become stepping stones that we use to rise higher. And I've been teaching a lot on the yoga of happiness lately. And I think that's really key, like how to be supremely happy in this life is to learn how to stay in the conflict and learn from the experience, because happiness is concealed. Happiness is behind every experience that we have. We just need to learn how to access and open the door that's to happiness that's behind the experience. Yeah. So he has creation in one arm. His hair represents the Ganges River. First of all, his dreadlocks, I don't know if you can see these little spiky things, that's his hair. Those are his dreadlocks, which are horizontal, because he is moving so fast. He's in this state of ecstasy from the dance of life that his head is spinning so fast that his hair is flying out horizontal. But his head is still. So there's the paradox. He's moving so fast that he's still. You know, have you seen a spinning wheel? The hub will sometimes look still, but you see that the periphery is spinning.
Right.
So there's this teaching of always there's stability and freedom. There's always steadiness and wildness. And to have a happy, joyous life, we need a balance of both. You know, if we're too wild, we'll be hung over the next day, you know. But if we're too steady, we just get stagnant. We become stoic. We become rigid sometimes. So I found that this reminds me, like if I'm working too hard or whatever, you know, now I gotta, you know, take off on my bike, or I need to do something to lighten up, you know. So he's always gonna take us back to the place in the middle, which is the threshold, which is the place between our individual nature and our universal nature. And in that threshold, we get a choice to choose the life that we want to live, that we can transform ourselves, that we are the beings who can change ourselves and make new decisions, you know. But we have to get to the threshold in order to have that make an impact. Otherwise, we're stuck in our patterns. We still have samskaras, you know, the samskaras, you know, the scars from our past, the imprints, the grooves, all that still applies here. But through our practice, even Patanjali talks about this, that through meditation, we can actually prevent the samskaric seeds from sprouting that have not yet sprouted. And that's really key. Okay, so then in his other arm, so he has, let's see, well, there's three aspects. So he has the drum, which is creation, the hair, which also represents the Ganges River, which is sustenance. So it's like Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. You've heard of the sort of the Godhead of Hinduism is Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. So it's the creation, then the sustenance of that creation. And then in his other hand, he's holding a fire, which is the destruction, or we could say the transformation, you know, Shiva, the transformer. So we have birth, life, death, all there. And then in his other hand, he's like this. This is the Abhay Mudra, which means have no fear. The cycles are meant to be, you know. There's no real ending. Endings are beginnings that are concealed because the cycle is perpetual, you know. And then he has another arm. So he has two arms up, two arms down. And one of the arms down is crossing his heart like this. And it's called Nigraha, or the arm of concealment. And it's right in front of his heart. And when I first learned about this, I felt so received, because Nataraja is acknowledging that our hearts, we get confused. We get concealed. And we can only know 25% of anything in life. It's called rahasya, which means secret. And the universe is not trying to keep a secret from us, but rahasya, secreting, is the way the universe reveals itself. It reveals itself through hiding itself in plain sight. I can look at you and I can see you are a divine being, Jeremy, but you may have no clue at all. It's like, well, I sort of know that as a concept, but right now I'm feeling completely like depressed or whatever is going on, you know. So we get clouded over. Our emotions really are so real and they're so thick that they can obscure the light of consciousness behind. So he's saying, don't worry, your heart gets concealed. That's all part of the dance. Have no fear. That's the Abhaya Mudra. And the hand of the arm of concealment is in the Dola Mudra. It's the Mudra of Ganesh, pointing down to the lifted foot of grace. Mm-hmm. So the secret, the answer to the secret, we are concealed, but he's pointing grace. And what does that even mean, grace? Well, we know as yoga teachers, we need to learn how to let go, how to surrender. It's what I love about the yoga practice. It almost always ends in the corpse pose, you know. Like we do all these wild things in the class, and then we just die at the end because it's symbolic. We need to die to who we were yesterday because we are brand new today. So grace becomes really to remember grace, and the ego arises all from being so busy in life. The travesty of being so busy in life is that we forget our divine inheritance, you know, that we are all great beings. So the Nataraja reminds me to, you know, remember that in my true nature, I hold the light of divinity. Like, I am a being of divine light. I am a conduit of the great light of consciousness. You know, and I'm also my limited self too. Those who know me, they'll be able to tell you, oh yeah, he's got his stuff, as we all do. But I think it's how I witness my stuff, you know, like I have in my book, you know, there's a little bit of theme of shame and unworthiness, you know, because that's just kind of what happened to me growing up. You know, my sister shamed me, my teacher shamed me. I remember this is really silly, but I think your listeners will be able to relate to something like this because it happens to every kid. So I have an older sister, and she used to draw these when we were really young. She'd draw these really ugly pictures of me, and she would say, "This is Todd," and then put an arrow to the picture, and she would like show it to me like this. I would get so angry, you know, because I was so identified. You know, I just wanted to be loved. And, you know, I didn't think anything of it, but there are many little experiences like that that really chip away at our identity and our capacity to know ourselves as enough, as divine beings, as even more than worthy. So that feeling of unworthiness or feeling of lack, you know, I don't have what it takes, you know, followed me. I mean, until, you know, I started to get enough experience that I could say to myself, oh, I am making a difference in the world. Oh, maybe I am enough, you know. But the book really outlines the variety of experiences. And so, like, for me, how I view that is, well, everything in life is for my awakening. So I have practiced over the years, and really it's been a lot of internal work, is to stand in the gift of that wound for me. Now, we all have wounds from childhood, but how many of us are willing to get the gift or to see that wound as a gift? You know, for instance, like feeling unworthy all these years has helped me to have a lot of compassion for others who may have that same journey, like to really become themselves. In a way, I've had to really work to become myself. And, you know, the book was part of me being able to express that and let people know, no, guess what? There's love underneath that too. So it's not that we're wounded. It's how we see ourselves, you know. And if everything in life is for our awakening, then whatever the core wound is, and we all have usually one large, you know, core wound, but there can be smaller ones too that impact. That for me, that has become the yoga journey, because my happiness can only happen when I'm able to absolutely fully accept that younger, less evolved part of me who feels unworthy, who just wants to be loved. You know, I've had to like pull out another seat at the table. Like, can we invite those less evolved parts of us to sit at our table? And when we can say yes, there's healing.
In that experience as a child, you could have stopped at just reflecting on it and like, oh, my sister was mean, or oh, that sucked, or I didn't get appreciated or the love that I wanted. Or it's interesting how those experiences we have in life, we could stop at a surface level and say, oh, that's all that was, and then not see all this underlying. And I my experience myself as well, I would say, like, those things, there is an underlying opportunity, you could call it grace or love or the universe teaching you through this painful experience that is there. It's just like just one journal inquiry under the surface.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's beautifully said, Jeremy, because I think no matter what yoga path you follow, and there's so many of them, that yoga takes us deeper. It's designed to give us a deeper experience of life, so we can start to penetrate the rahasya, or what's concealed, that the secret that's there. And I think that's just partly how our consciousness has evolved as a species, but I think also the depth of the tantric view that holds the paradox. It says, no, we're both. Like, it's a non-dual path, but inside the word non-dual is duality. So we could say that the non-dual is so full that it includes duality. Like, it's so all-encompassing that it includes duality. In fact, there's another word for non-dual in the Vedanta tradition, which is really the oldest yogic tradition, and then the Advaita Vedanta, which is really the end of the Vedas, and maybe you've heard of the Upanishads, which were the text or the scripture that came out at the end of the Vedic period, has the word called Advaita or Advaita, which means not two. So they can't say unity consciousness because the saying of the word already separates it. So they have to kind of say not two to mean one. And what they're meaning by that is this idea of unity consciousness everywhere. But even in the Advaita Vedanta tradition, they say that the difference that we see, like there's you and there's me, they're saying that's not real, that's Maya, because we're really one. And so that word Advaita refers to that. Like, life is still a problem. The problem is that we're misinterpreting everything as difference, and that's the mistake. Tantra comes along and changes the word Advaita to Adwaya. Now, I know I'm not a Sanskrit scholar. Some of my teachers were Sanskrit scholars, so I got a lot of this from them. But the term Advaya means never without duality. It's a unity that's never without duality. And when I heard that, it just blew my mind, because it put everything into perspective, that this paradox that we're living of difference, the difference is not Maya and illusion, the difference is actually real, you know, and that we celebrate our differences, you know, that yes, we share the five elements, we all breathe the same air, we all have a heart, we all experience, you know, emotions, and there's a beautiful teaching around this whole idea that encompasses these concepts. And it's the notion that I am nothing like you. I am something like you. So I'm nothing like you is just straight duality. We are completely different. I am something like you starts to consider that we have certain things in common. You know, we both have two eyes, nose, face, you know, mouth. And all that, we, you know, we're humans. But then it's the third level, is I am nothing but you. I'm nothing like you. I'm something like you. I'm nothing but you. Which, and all those three things are true all at the same time, you know. So it's just a very, I find it a very holistic, full, accepting, compassionate view that's no less than paths that want to transcend, you know, because Tantra takes you as deep as you want to go. It's known as the path, at least the Tantra that I teach and study is the path for householder yogis, you know, like most of us, you know. But you know, my background was in living at an ashram. I renounced the world. When I was 22, I had this, amazing experience. It was like a heart transformation, a spiritual emergency, actually, that shifted my whole life. I was a musician. I actually was a jazz piano major. And I visited my friend at, it happened to be Kripalu Center at that time, but it was in Pennsylvania back in 1982. And he convinced me to stay for a 10-day course, and I stayed for 13 years. Now, what happened there was that I had to cancel my, I had a fellowship in a jazz program, a whole master's degree program was given to me, you know, as a fellowship. I had to cancel all that. And, you know, our life, you know, it, my life took a big dog leg turn, you know. But I think what happens is I was always like following my heart, like moving in the direction of my heart, trying to figure it out, especially at that young age. And instead of wanting to be a musician, one of my teachers at Kripalu said, yoga is learning how to be a musician of life. And that just broadened my perspective so much. Just like, yeah, I mean, I love, you know, perfecting music and all that. But really what I wanted was, how can I be happier? How can I really make the most of this life? And how can I be in service to other people?
That was that like a easy decision? Did you just stop playing music and just focus on yoga?
No, it was very different. I give the whole experience in like technicolor detail in my book, but it was a very difficult experience. I mean, I had like a spiritual break that took me several months to recover from. And when I did recover from that, I was a changed person. And I realized that yoga was calling me, you know. And then my life path was clear. I just had to keep following my heart. And of course, my parents freaked out. They thought I joined a cult. Maybe I did. I'm not in denial of it, you know. But in my mind, it was an intentional community of people that just wanted to, like, discover their spirit and live the fullest life and then serve others. Like, these values that I resonate so deeply with, even to today. Like, I still have the same vision. I remember back then, I was like, I just want to bring heaven on earth. You know, I'm so idealistic. But, you know, deep down, I still wanted, like, that's still like the motivating force for me. How to bring more ease into the world, how to bring more peace into the world. And I think it's the highest thing we can do, how to bring more happiness into the world as yoga teachers, you know, to help people feel more comfortable in their body. My method is about integrating the body, mind, and heart, you know, so I teach a lot of this philosophy. I teach emotional agility, you know, like how do we dance through our emotions? There's not many yoga paths or methods that instruct sort of the detail of how do we align with our emotions and really work skillfully with them such that the emotion, you know, I call them emotion, energy in motion, and to learn about how they function and what is the message that emotions are trying to give us.
What was the main emotion when you were going through that spiritual emergency? Was it fear, anger? What was it?
Oh, I went through the full range. The first was fear, like a very intense fear. I think what was going on is what I think really happened was, you know, in sort of yogic language, is I had a huge heart opening. It was a Shaktipat Kundalini awakening because it affected my entire being and I was not in control of it. A window opened up in my consciousness where I had this view of universal consciousness. I could read people's minds. I could read people's emotions. I was filled with so much joy and ecstasy that I didn't know what to do with it. And there's a moment when I was so sort of God ecstatic that I was guided to go up on the top of this hill behind the ashram and become natural man. I took my contact lenses off and flung them. I didn't need those. I took off all my clothes. I didn't need those. And I attempted to walk back to the ashram as my natural self. So meanwhile, they're practicing celibacy in this ashram. Okay. And here's this naked guy come, and I had to cross two or three public properties like homes and stuff But I was oblivious. I was God intoxicated. And I walked, and luckily the administrator saw me and whipped me into the brother's barn quickly. I found out like decades later that there are a few of the women there that did see me, and they would go, "Oh my God, who's that naked person over there?" They hadn't seen a naked person like in a long time. So I went through a lot of those kinds of experiences. Actually, my parents had to come. They were going through a divorce at that time. I had like a difficult family unit situation that was really just exploding and ending. And long story short, some relatives came to pick me up because I was in no shape to drive. I went to the psychiatric hospital in Philadelphia, and my program was 10 days at the retreat center, which is called Quest of the Limitless You, by the way. And my treatment in the hospital was exactly 10 days. And during that time, I went through the fullest range of intense, I call them kriyas or acts of purification. I did have to go into isolation there because I was out of control with anger. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. I was not there. I had a little bit of window of insight because I do remember flailing my arms around and going through intense emotions. I remember mantras flying out of my mouth. I had no idea what they meant. And I remember just having a huge release, like emotionally. And that all seemed to calm down after a few days. I brought with me some audio recordings of the teachings, you know, that I had just been subject to of the teacher at that time. And I felt like I got myself grounded into the yogic teachings again. And after 10 days, I was fine. You know, I left and recovered at my aunt and uncle's house for a while. I had changed my diet just before then. Like, I really hadn't been vegetarian, but during that whole time I was vegetarian, I lost tremendous weight. You know, I'm a thin person. I lost maybe 20 pounds. I went down to 122, which is like my normal weight is around 135, 140. And so anyway, I'm sure I had a lot of sort of physical imbalance that kind of caused that experience to happen. But when I look back, it was really the perfect storm to give me exactly what I needed, because after that experience, I was completely changed. So I went through a lot of emotions, and then all I wanted to do was go back to the ashram, but they put me on the awareness list. It's like, oh, this person is a legal threat. My dad threatened to sue, you know, the ashram because of what happened, and he never did. And so they let me come back little at a time over the next couple of months and years. And no, it was actually a year later, they let me move in to try it for a month. And that's when I did perfectly fine. And I stayed for, you know, 13 years total is when I stayed.
So you were in your early 20s, you found out about this sort of retreat experience, and then you went, and then towards the end of that, you had this sort of spiritual awakening, transcendent experience. And that's kind of the sequence, right? It was, mm-hmm. Was there any particular incident that like caused that, or was it kind of just being there in the field or spontaneous?
Well, yeah, and I give a lot more detail in my book, but we did so much deep internal work. Right at that time, do you know who Jean Houston is? She's like a visionary revolutionist, you know, and she's older now, but the first book that she wrote that became really popular was called Human Potential, something like that. Human Potential. And she really was one of the ones that started the Human Potential movement, which was this whole body-mind exploration. So we did a bunch of, it's called The Possible Human. So we did a lot of the exercises out of that book, which were psychologically just super powerful, to actually help you make peace with all aspects of your life. Mm-hmm. So we were doing that. We were doing very intense pranayama and asana work. And then the guru or the teacher there started giving, you know, sessions for everybody there. Probably halfway through the course, we had maybe five mornings, and these were intense sessions. These were, you know, I don't know how you want to say it, but it was like the teacher giving the blessing of spiritual transformation to all those who were open to it. And I was extremely open. And then we would meet with him at satsang in the evening. So I think it was like two doses of that every day for 5 or 6 days is really what did it. And, you know, not everybody responds to the life force energy or the Shakti that way, but it was the perfect time and I was in the perfect place. For whatever reason, my soul was just ready to receive what it needed to receive to, you know, I look back and I said, yeah, that was a pivotal point in my life. So
were they teaching the tantra that you teach and practice now, or was this later that you kind of found this path?
Yeah, it was much later. The guru of the guru there was in the renunciate tradition. So there's a lot of teaching about how to transcend. There's still really valuable and beautiful teachings, but it wasn't so much rooted in the householder tantric path. There were some blends of tantra in there because there's, you know, everybody's open to being influenced by everybody else. But it was more or less a classical path. Like purification was really important. We were all told to practice celibacy, and that if we, you know, fell in love, we had to attenuate our desires because family life was lower than the spiritual monk, like life of a monk. So there was this separation. There was a superior path. And I had a lot of friends who were there at the, they came as a family, you know, so they had kids and stuff like that. I don't know how they felt, but there's always, you know, they were accepted, but there was always this emphasis on, no, the higher path is like over here. But then you may or may not know, but there was a huge scandal that happened many years later. That's in 1994, where the guru finally had to admit he was lying to all of us, that he was, you know, sexual abuse of power. All these things came out, and it was horrible. I had no idea, which is part of my path of like sort of waking up, not being so gullible and trusting. The community actually fell apart, broke apart, and I think the teacher ended up paying a lot of reparations. And anyway, he set up another compound down in Florida, so he is still, you know, going strong. But it was horrendous for me, and it was really quite a betrayal for many of those who lived there. And I dedicated 13 years of my life there, and you know. Yeah. So that was another part of my awakening, to grieve and feel anger from all that, and then finally get to the other side of it where I could forgive, and instead of betrayal being as sort of an impasse, because who doesn't get betrayed? I think if you've been loved, you've been betrayed, because it's a feature that comes maybe not in the earlier stages of life, but eventually betrayal is a way, it's actually the breaking of trust is how trust goes deeper, that intimacy requires a certain quality where the trust is challenged, you know, and then if you stay with it and you work through it, the intimacy, if you still want that with that person, it goes deeper, you know.
Yes.
So it's not a straight line. It's a very twisting, turning, crooked path. But the point I was making was that instead of betrayal becoming an impasse, it became a rite of passage for me, to step more deeply into my own heart. And it's not so much my trust for others as it is, can I trust myself? And if I can really, really trust myself, then I don't need to put my trust so heavily in others, because everybody's a human being and, you know, we do the best we can and things happen. So, but if I have my own self-trust, then I'm solid and I can stand my ground, you know, and set up the healthy self boundaries that I needed to have. So I left that whole Kripalu path because there's something not working about the whole philosophy in the yoga. And then I found Anusara Yoga, which was a path of alignment. It was the founder of Anusara would bring the tantric scholars in to teach us. And so that's how I got exposed to all this tantric teaching, which was specific to householder path. It's a very high path. It wasn't superior to renuncia, but it was equal. They're just two different streams. And the householder path made so much more sense, like how to transform myself through being an active participant in the world rather than having to renounce or reject the world.
Yeah, I think of it, and my understanding is a lot of it, the renunciate path in classical yoga, even Patanjali, is a lot of vertical, of going to reach samadhi, reach moksha, go beyond the physical, and sometimes even the tapas of like punishing my body, like totally whittle my body down to just bones and starve myself, and show that like I can transcend the need for food and water. And that's all vertical, but then there's the horizontal path, which is relational. It's between individuals. It's being in the body, being in my understanding of more like this is the tantra path you're talking about. Yes. And in that way, like, there's no teacher to say, oh, I'm above this and I don't have that, and pretend they don't have a shadow and pretend they don't have any flaws.
Yeah.
To look like they are above and to reach this level so you can reach it too. But on the horizontal, it's you know, I think we can have both, but I'm just always highly skeptical at this point in my own studies. And, you know, you have a lot more experience than me, but to anybody who pretends like they don't have a shadow, or like that our goal is to never have a shadow, or
right,
to be above that, you know.
I'm so glad you brought that out, Jeremy. I'm reminded of a quote from Deepak Chopra. He said, if you don't think you have a shadow, you must not be standing in the light.
Right.
And that's really it. And I think at Kripalu there was a big shadow. Like, it just was not expressed. It wasn't embraced. And we were taught to transcend all these sort of human lesser qualities. And you're right. Tantra is learning how to embrace the full spectrum of ourselves. So when I was in the Anusara tradition, you know, I was there, I became a senior certified teacher. I was on the ethics committee, the curriculum committee. Like, I really was involved. I was teaching the teacher trainings, 15 years there. And then the same darn thing happened. Like, there was a scandal, you know, and I saw that as beautiful as the Anusara path was, there was still sort of this rejection of the shadow. You know, we weren't really taught how to stand in the gift of our wounds. And so I was again devastated again, but because I'd gone through the betrayal the first time, this was a little bit easier, but betrayal is never easy. I mean, I don't care how good you get at that, it hurts. And but if that hadn't happened, then I would not have had the intense motivation and tenacity to develop my own form of yoga, which is Ashaya Yoga, which means abode of the heart, which is the integration of body, mind, and heart. My goal is to actually help people become well-versed, we could say masters, of their whole being, including our emotional stance, you know, how we feel, and to connect that into, you know, feelings are also divine. Like, it's all divine, it's all sacred. That every part, every piece, every fiber of your being is lovable and divine. And in that way, we move forward, you know, through life. So
it's beautiful. Yeah. And I think of children, when you were talking earlier about betrayal and like how that can lead to greater connection, and how kids can have strong emotions and say, I hate you, I'm mad. You know, they express this anger.
Right.
In a way, the deeper communication is like, will you love me here? You know, it's what I understand. What yes. They're really saying, you know. And I think that happens in so many levels of like, we can have these hurts, these emotions, these reactions, and the deeper need is to be loved through all of that. And if there is a break in trust or connection, can we repair that and come back to the heart? And you know, sometimes these leaders who have these communities don't make those repairs, and then the community goes away or falls apart.
But
I think that's like so human and so basic, and we see it, I see it in children, and I think children are great teachers of, you know, how to navigate emotions, because they can't just always say, oh, just, you know, meditate and transcend your anger.
Right. That's just a beautiful analogy there, like kids and their emotions. And I think you're spot on, Jeremy. What we want, we all have this primal need for to be loved and to belong. And it's for our survival. It's not just like to help us feel happy in our emotions. These are survival instincts. And I think there's a beautiful yoga that takes all that into consideration. And, you know, that's really what sort of the essence of Ashaya Yoga. I teach on the five elements, so earth, water, fire, air, and sky, because we all come from the elements. You know, we're all star babies in a way. We come from the stars. And that's a beautiful metaphor, is that we come from this one infinite universal energy to become limited, blessed and limited in the form that we are, to be able to discover our unlimited nature. Yeah, to me, that's the whole joy of the yoga. So in that sense, limitations are not limitations, they're doorways to the unlimited. And
like that, you said that at the beginning too, of how essentially limitations are important to have, in sense of limitations of my role and identity, or your role and identity, or the practices we do, the limitations of the body, like to be a householder. I love that approach of, again, it's not trying to just transcend and break free of those limitations, but to see them as the path to liberation. And you're right.
That's it, to see them as the path to liberation. Because when you look at your life with the eyes of grace, the ordinary becomes extraordinary. And we start to recognize divinity in all things. And there is nothing more ecstatic than that. And that's what Nataraja is telling us, that, hey, all of this is the dance. There's movement and there's steadiness. He wears a snake that's like a belt and a sash that comes around. And the snake always represents that the mastery of this life force Kundalini energy, and the mastery of our desires, such that desires are not to be transcended. You know, desire is not part of the problem, but in this particular tantra, the desire becomes the source of the solution, because it's the universe who desired out of its own delight to become you, as you. And when we start to recognize that, wow, the universe went through a lot of trouble to become us, you know, that we have a deeper appreciation. And, you know, I like to think, like, there's three questions that Tantra asks. What does your heart most deeply desire? And I like that because there's the word desire. What does your heart most deeply desire? What value is it to you? And what are you prepared to do about it? And that those three questions have been the three questions that have guided me, you know, really through the ups and downs of, you know, the Kripalu path that I had that whole experience, and the Anusara path that led me to found my own method of yoga, and that continues to help guide me, you know, through the waves of life, you know. So
how, let's say somebody listening to this is not entirely sure what their heart desires. How do you navigate that?
Well, you have to know, first of all, that there's no wrong answer. So what your heart desires is really a wide open, it's like a blank canvas where you have a palette of all the colors. And you just have to go inside your heart and see, like, what pleases you? You know, what colors please you? What experiences do you want to have? And I think there's another way, like if someone says, I don't know what I most deeply desire, that you allow that to be okay. And you be in the space of don't know. And you just hang out there for some time. And, you know, as yogis, we know how to breathe. Can you breathe more space into that? Because really, it's more of an issue of self-recognition, self-identity. We all know deep inside what it is that we most deeply desire. But sometimes we don't have the words for it, or we can't put our finger on it. So I encourage my students to, you know, if they say, well, how do you know what you want? And it's like, well, give yourself some space to breathe into the not knowing of what that is and see what shows up. And sometimes journal writing is a great way. One of the exercises I give to my students is I have them tune in. Actually, this is in the book right near the end, is you open yourself to the vastness of this universal non-dual energy. And then you let it pour through you. You're just the conduit. And you put your pen on the paper and you start writing as if the universe were speaking through you. And you start with what I want you to know is. And that puts you in an objective mind space, you know, where you can be the witness, and then you just write whatever comes out. It doesn't even have to be sentences. There could be words or phrases, and you just let go and see what comes through. And oftentimes in that experience, what your heart most deeply desires gets revealed to you. You know, we're pulling it out of the rahasya, which is that concealed part. Remember, we've got the arm crossing the heart. But his other hand is saying, hey, have no fear. It's okay to not know. Like, that's part of the experience. So
that's beautiful. That's powerful. I'm going to do that exercise. I'm going to pick up your book soon. Thank you for sharing that with us.
You're welcome.
And I feel, just before we finish, one thing I want to ask is, because you have this unique experience of being so devoted and immersed in these cultures, and then the unfortunate experience of the betrayals there, I know culture has changed a bit since then, and there's a lot more visibility on issues and communities now. But if somebody has, maybe they're not sure if they've been in that, like maybe they joined a community and they always had, like, something feels a little off, or they weren't sure, like, you know, they learned these teachings, but I'm not sure if those were actually healthy teachings. You know, maybe their teacher wasn't part of a big scandal, but something just felt a little bit off to them. I know I've talked to people who've been in this kind of scenario at other times. So how do you, like, make sense of that? Because it must have been quite a process for you to reconcile, like, you know, taking the good, learn this, but, you know, this was not.
Yeah. Well, I go back to the teaching, one of the ones in Ashaya that I teach is everything in life is for your awakening, and life always has your back. So when I look back at those experiences, I can bow with gratitude, because if I had not had that experience, I wouldn't have the wisdom that I have today. So we have to look back, like, that's part of, like, how do we become, like, emotional agility with this, the strong emotion of grief, because we can, grief is like quicksand. We need to open to grief, because grief holds this deep interconnection with ourselves. But if you go into it too much, you can, your whole life is colored by this grief and sadness, and there's, and it's not meant to do that, you know? So we have to find where's the bottom for us and where's the boundary. And when we get that, when we allow grief, when we can surrender to grief, it will carry you like a buoy back up to the surface, but you have to surrender to it. And then instead of looking at what we just lost, we start to see what we gained. Because there is truth. We didn't just lose somebody. What did that person give us? So when I look back at, it wasn't just that I got betrayed at Kripalu, it gave me my spiritual foundation that was so powerful. The yoga was always true. So it's, we have to have enough consciousness that we can, you know, not throw the baby out with the bathwater. And then we're right back in the paradox. It's called cognitive dissonance. Can you hold the good and bad? And I'm telling you, this, for us as teachers, this is a spiritual practice, because you're only going to be able to hold the light and dark of those experiences to the extent that you can hold the light and dark of yourself. So my capacity to integrate all those experiences and make room for, you know, the mistakes that the leader made, to understand that maybe he wasn't intentional about it until later, you know, to understand that everybody makes mistakes, like, to be able to hold that, I have to, can I sit with my own darkness? I mean, that's really the essence. The extent that I can sit in my own darkness, at the extent that I can have compassion for somebody else in their darkness. So I think it comes back to our own deep spiritual practice. Like, I do yoga to help me create more love and acceptance for who I am, and to be open to learn so I can change, evolve, and grow and become the better version of myself as I go through life. Like, the best thing about being old, I'm kind of old, I don't know, maybe compared to you and a lot of the other listeners, you know, is that as we age, hopefully we have more and more wisdom, so that as I get older, I'm actually happier. And I see that as the journey, that as we go through this life, we become more and more happy. We can dance even more fully, and we're spinning our heads even more, because the ecstasy gets more and more and more. And anyway.
Jesus is very old, so yeah. Beautiful. Thank you for your time today, Todd. I know you've got a lot of beautiful offerings. I'd love for you to share how people can stay in touch with you, where they can find you, how they can work with you going forward.
Sure. Well, my website is ashayayoga.com. It's A-S-H-A-Y-A-Y-O-G-A, Ashaya Yoga. And there you'll find the membership. So I teach on Tuesdays and Thursdays online. And the membership is just a phenomenal way to get connected to the alignment method that I teach, the philosophy that I teach. We also study mantra. So we do japa mantra, pranayama, meditation. It's like the full experience of yoga that way. And then I offer teacher trainings. I have a 200-hour course. I just finished one. I have another one coming up in November of 2023. So usually once, sometimes twice a year, I do a 200-hour teacher training, which is another great way to learn the method for sure, but also the philosophy. And I'm starting to travel again. So I'll be at the Omega Institute this coming July. I teach at Kripalu three times a year. So in October and April, I'm at Kripalu with a weekend workshop. I have a New Year's retreat at Kripalu. And I do some online courses as well. I'm going to teach on the chakras in the fall. It's a 10-course online series. So you know, you can stay in touch, join my newsletter. And I have so many free classes on YouTube and Facebook. I'm doing, I was doing like one a week for like forever. So I have like hundreds of classes. And I'm starting another free workshop series that you have to register for, but I'll be doing it, you know, free on Facebook Live once a month. So that's coming up actually next week. So.
Shai Yoga, Todd Norman, Tantra Yoga. So good to have you here today. Thank you for being here, and hope we get to talk soon in the future.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thanks for being so open-minded and open-hearted. Yeah, you're really great. Appreciate it.
My honor. Thank you.